From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, how crime data analysis is changing the face of law enforcement. Then a traumatic brain injury turns mild-mannered Jason Padgett into a mathematical Superman.
There was a lot of times, you know, in that 3 years where I was by myself where I was like, you know, when you see somebody that's really crazy and they don't know it, am I one of those people right now that I'm drawing all this stuff and saying, this is pi at this value, and I'm the only one that thinks it, you know, and I just don't know that I'm crazy?
And writer Mona Simpson compares her Wisconsin hometown to the place she calls home now.
No one could, certainly I couldn't, but I think almost no one could fully understand California, you know, Southern California. There's so many factors in its history. It's so big. It's got so many huge issues. I don't yet, but I feel like I maybe could understand Green Bay.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Over the last few months, there have been some periodic outbreaks of violence in Milwaukee, weekends or other several-day stretches with sudden increases in shootings or other criminal unrest. While those outbreaks are still often difficult to predict, the ability to forecast trends in crime has evolved a great deal in recent years thanks to the work of crime data analysts. That field is the fastest-growing wing of the crime-fighting equation, and its ranks include a growing number of graduates of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of Criminal Justice. Alexandra Snowden is an assistant professor of criminal justice. Ruben Burgos is a longtime veteran of the Milwaukee Police Department, who's now a senior lecturer at UWM. They join me now in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
What does a crime analyst do?
Well, they do. They provide actionable intelligence for the police department. At the local, the lower level, the tactical level for the police officers, they give us information on where the hotspots are, trends and analysis of what's going on that the officers and supervisors can use as actionable intelligence.
Now, you say actual intelligence, but intelligence has always been a part of police work, but this has changed to some degree. You're distinguishing things like hunches from hard data?
Yes. We've been doing pin maps and things like that for 20 years on the police department, as long as I can remember. But now it's factual. This is the data, today's data, last week's data, last 7 days, 6 weeks' data, exactly where it's happening, what time it's happening, the suspects, the cars, information that the police officers need right now to find the bad guy.
Well, and I think just about anybody who's watched a police show on TV is familiar with the pin map. You know, contrast, you know, this idea of like putting pins or drawing circles over places on the map with the kind of data that police now get from analysts.
So, for example, now some of the data that we look into is about location where some of the crimes have occurred. And so we can use this information about pinpointing where exactly some of the hotspots are in the areas and then follow up, as Ruben was saying, with further intelligence about why are those hotspots there and not elsewhere.
But presumably the data alone isn't enough necessarily to predict where the next crime will be. There have to be people on the force who know how to interpret this data, right?
Yes, that's what we're the analysts for. We ask them, you know, tell us where are the hotspots, and they access all the databases we have. We have numerous databases on the Milwaukee Police Department, record management systems, the CAD systems. They access all these programs, do their magic, and then they come out with some intelligence or some analysis and give us what time and place so that we can put the police officers in the right spot.
Well, and so what are the kind of skills that someone who goes into this field has to acquire to be effective in it?
Well, they have to be very logical, intuitive, looking at what's going on there, have some access to the mapping softwares without the technology, and be able to politically talk to supervisors. Some of the problems is police don't like to be told by civilians what to do. And they're civilians. They're not police officers, and they have to schmooze the police officers. And that's part of the job. It works with the right personality.
Well, and that's an interesting point because that's not always the kind of stuff that someone gets in an academic environment. But is it something that you stress to students who are coming up through the field that they're going to be civilians working in a much different environment than if they went to some other kind of IT job, for example?
We do.
Yeah, how do you teach schmoozing?
Well, when we had the interns at the Intelligence Fusion Center, we would talk to them, say, you know, this is, they ask us, what do they really want? They get this request for data information, and what do they want? And we'd have to talk, well, we think this is what they want. Make sure you ask the right questions, and then find out what they're looking for so you can help them get the right answer.
We also teach students how to be careful thinkers about, we can show you where the crimes are, but you have to think further than just this map. You have to think, why are these patterns the way they are? And we also make sure that they understand that they need to take a project from the beginning to the end. And learning those skills in a classroom environment and then also having the exposure in a real-world environment using real-world data helps our students be very successful.
These are statistics, but the statistics are impacted by people, and people aren't always predictable, right?
One could argue that, but then on the other hand, our statistics would allow us to make some probabilistic predictions about when and where crimes would occur, and then we rely on hunches and further intelligence, as Ruben was saying earlier, about acting up on those probabilistic sort of occurrences.
Well, and if I read between the lines, Ruben, you were on the force for more than three decades. I would imagine there are a lot of people in the field of police work who, to put it nicely, might be suspicious of this kind of data.
Yes, especially, you know, when Chief Flynn came to the police department seven years ago, he brought in the data-driven policing and a lot of technology. Well, police are resistant, and it took a little bit of time for our crime analysts to show them this is why it works. And eventually they did come, most of them came around and say, hey, this is some good intelligence, gives us a good leads. We still have to be out there doing the legwork, but it took some time to get the older officers, the older officers to acknowledge that this is some good information for them.
Can you give us some real world examples of how this data work actually leads to changes in or advances in police work?
Real world.
Well, I mean, like,
hotspots.
Yeah, I mean, give us an example of, you know, what hotspots really are and how they lead to, you know, differences in policing.
Well, we know that by looking at the statistics that these kind of crimes occur in certain times, locations. It affects staffing. It affects other units working together, the intelligence division, the vice squad, the gang squad. They all work together, and we see that the problem is. What is the actual underlying issues, drugs or gangs or whatever it is? We network. And that's where the intelligence has helped us. The problem over here is a burglary issue, but that's really a drug issue. So we work together. We reach out to other units, and we then become, you know, a better teamwork.
What are the challenges that people face time and again that you see, you know, you would have seen in the Intelligence Fusion Unit, for example?
Patience. We know that the hotspot, say 27th and Main Street, and we know it's there, it's going to happen, but nothing happens. We give them predictions, we give, you know, put coppers out on the street and nothing happens. And they say, that's all a bunch of BS. It doesn't work. And they go off and do other things. You got to have patience because the numbers don't lie. Statistics doesn't lie. It's going to happen. It's just we have to be patient in that sometimes we know the crime's going to be. We assign people there. It gets bored. They want to do the real policing and run around chasing people, and they leave. They don't put the effort in.
Who are the kind of people that go into this field? Is it people that are interested in police work, people that are interested in statistics, some combination of both of them? Who's the right person for the job?
Some of the successful students that I've had in the past were simply very curious individuals that wanted to answer questions about the areas or the types of people that become apprehended for criminal activity. And so it's students who are curious about numbers, about working with numbers, but also are curious about and interested in making a difference in improving communities.
I've noticed also some of the my students who don't want to be actual police officers, but they do want to help. They want to influence in their community. what can they do and not be a police officer? And this is a very good way to help, and it's a nice career.
This is like an ability to help solve crimes without necessarily the danger of being shot at.
Correct. And the hours and the cold and all the elements out there, being out in the elements.
How much difference does it make in terms of timing of response? You know, we keep hearing about, you know, this was a violent weekend, or it's been a violent couple of weeks in Milwaukee. How is it different today when something like that happens versus, say, 10 or 15 years ago from the standpoint of, response times, quickness to be able to analyze these patterns?
Well, we know that the areas where the problem is going to be, we put the police officers in the area. If when it happens, the shots fired, they go off, we have police officers in those neighborhoods. They just have to be redirected to those locations. We know that for the most part, people don't call the police when there are shots fired through some of the technology we have. But we know that if they see the police, they'll notify those police officers. So it really helps having the police officers in the neighborhoods where they're needed, and then the people then they feel they can call and contact those individuals.
The violence and violent crimes have been declining across the United States, and that's one thing that we keep forgetting about. But because we want response that's quick and we want to do things that can prevent further violence, we want response very quickly, even though violence as a whole across the state, across the nation, has been on decline.
There has always been statistical analysis, and people have always been smart. So what has happened in recent years to make this field more effective? Is it just computer technology?
I think it is. A reason is computer technology, but the second and I think more important reason is availability of data. We live in an information age where we have so much data, and we need to figure out how to sort through all of this mass amount of big data to make important policy implications, prevent crimes from occurring and things like that. But it could be also developments in computer technology.
Well, you know, like you said, the access to technology, you know, the criminal is not going to stay in Milwaukee. They're going to go to West Dallas, to Whitefish Bay. They're going to go all over the country, over the state and county. And we now can act, the analysts can access this information through the databases. They get access to the state databases, the drug databases. And if you know how to use them and pull from them, and that's what our analysts do, they can get a lot of information that we never got before because we didn't have access to the county sheriff's database. We didn't have access to the state Department of Criminal Investigation database. And that's where the technology has really helped us to reach out to other avenues of intelligence that we weren't accessing unless it was a personal phone call or email or phone number or something like that would call.
Certainly. I mean, the other comparison I would imagine is to like electronic medical records, the ability that a doctor has to see everything that a patient has gone through. This is now something that police investigators have access to as well.
Exactly. And then we ask our analysts to make sure they understand what databases are available to them. There's lists and lists of databases that we have access to, not just public databases, also the restricted databases for law enforcement and other things that we have. And we have analysts who work with the federal government who can give us classified information also.
How is this field growing at UWM? What sorts of opportunities are there for students to learn this stuff?
There are vast, especially within our school. At the undergraduate level, we have several important developments where students can earn a certificate, a specialization, or a minor. And also, the latest exciting development is within our master's degree. We have plans to put forward a master's degree with concentration in crime analytics as early as this upcoming spring. Those are the plans.
The job field is wide open. The police department in Milwaukee is hired three analysts this year. All over the country, every department realizes the value of crime analysis, and they're going to start hiring more as these graduates come through with these degrees, certificates, and minors. It's a great field for someone who doesn't actually want to be a police officer but wants to really make a difference in the community.
Well, Ruben Burgos and Alexandra Snowden, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Alex Snowden is an assistant professor of criminal justice at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Ruben Burgos was an investigator with the Milwaukee Police Department for more than 30 years. He's now a senior lecturer in the criminal justice department at UWM. Jason Padgett's life changed after a mugging and assault, but probably not the way you would imagine. His unique story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. In September of 2002, Jason Padgett was 31 and managing his family's futon shop in Tacoma, Washington. His life was a whirlwind of working out, drinking, girls, and karaoke bars. And it was leaving a karaoke bar that his life changed forever. Padgett was mugged, and the resulting injuries caused a profound change in his brain chemistry. Overnight, he acquired an intrinsic understanding of advanced mathematics, a subject he'd never studied and for which he had no prior aptitude. Additionally, he developed synesthesia, in which two or more senses overlap. In Padgett's case, he sees light broken into its mathematical components. Padgett details his story in a memoir called Struck by Genius, How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. On a recent visit to Milwaukee, Padgett spoke with Bonnie North and described how he viewed the lights in the Lake Effect studio.
Light, when it comes at me, it looks like that bursting point. If you look at a drawing of pi and you see those little lines bursting outwards, that's always what it looks like. And when I move, of course, it looks like little picture frames of it. But instead of like the pie as I draw it, technically is the geometry of the rainbow. So all I'm seeing is the burst here, whereas the light beams that are coming out and they're hitting and bouncing off at the angle they hit at. So, you know, the geometry winds up being different, but they're always identical to the center burst of the drawing of pie.
Are there colors involved, or is it just the light color that you see?
You know, just the color that I see. It's like I don't see like the letter T is blue, that type of thing like some people do. Everything is like a grid structure.
The reason I asked you about this is because when you were 31, your life changed utterly.
Yes.
Utterly. A lot of people say they have life-changing experiences, but yours truly shifted down to your brain chemistry.
Yes.
So what happened?
Well, I went to a little karaoke bar. I had a friend there, and she was on a first date with this guy, and they were singing karaoke, and they had too much to drink, and they wanted me to come pick him up. And so I went there, sang a song, Bon Jovi's Blaze of Glory, and then had a Coke, you know, paid for it, and then left. There was these two guys that were also singing. They were clean cut. They looked like normal people. They didn't look like, you know, too rough. And as we left, they followed us out and were behind us, and then I was attacked by them. As we left.
And you sustained some traumatic brain injury.
Yes.
Because of that.
Yeah. I didn't even see it coming. I just saw literally like somebody took a picture, a bright white flash of light, and felt this deep thud in the back of my head. And the next thing I knew, I was on my knees trying to figure out, why am I on my knees? Why is the world spinning? Why am I getting hit from all these different directions? It was so just completely disorientating trying to figure out what's going on after, even though it was just, I was only unconscious from the time that I was standing to hitting my knees, it still takes you a second to even get any type of bearings back. Yes, I sustained a head injury or brain injury from this and went to the hospital afterwards, and they just diagnosed me with a severe concussion and a bleeding kidney and then sent me home with some pain medicine.
When did it first become apparent to you that it wasn't just a concussion?
I thought it was the pain medicine at first. I was like, this pain medicine is some wild stuff. And then the next day it was obvious. It was like, okay, that stuff is not in me. This is something that has changed radically. And it was so pretty. And the symmetry involved, it was beautiful. It was stunning. I mean, I remember watching water going down the drain and then just flushing the toilet over and over and watching it.
Because you were seeing patterns?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Instead of things looking smooth like they used to before, like imagine moving your hand in front of your face, it looks like it's moving smoothly. But our brain is actually taking pictures just like a TV is. When you're watching a TV, for instance, you're seeing 40 or 50 frames per second and your brain, you know, shows that as motion. And there's a smooth, continuous motion. It's like those old flip books. If you make a picture and then you flip through it, you can see the image changing, but it's jittery. That's how everything looks now, because there's a part of our brain that all it does is it smooths out the pictures that we take. And that's gone now. Everything, instead of having this smoothness, is all jittery. Best way to think of it is like individual, discrete pictures with little filaments connecting the frames. And clouds or water, instead of looking like these smooth spirals, look like these little tangent lines that are changing. So there's this order to it, and it's a form, a recursive form of the Pythagorean theorem. It's like a squared plus b squared equals c. Then you re-input c as a, and if how you b, you could say b equals one, or you could change it, and that'll make it spirals faster or longer.
So basically, it sounds like what you lost was your brain's ability to smooth in those in between spaces.
Definitely, yes.
Okay,
and it makes everything look like pixelated. So what I started doing is mentally overlaying a grid, like a piece of graph paper, on everything that I'm looking at. And I found that as long as I made the grid sufficiently fine or tiny, that I could make the motion of everything that I'm looking at line up with a vertex point on the grid. And as it turns out, that's what calculus is dividing things up into these smaller and smaller grids or subintervals. And the smaller you divide it, and the more accurate your measurement gets. So it's like being forced to see in calculus.
Which is so fascinating, because you had no math background
before this.
That was another big change that happened with this. But let's back up just a second, because you didn't immediately in those first days after you had your injury jump to this. It took you a long time to get back into the world again.
Yeah. For a little more than 3 years, I just holed up in my house. I had blankets over the windows. I mean, not a beam of light got in. I didn't leave the house unless I had to buy groceries, and only when I was out of everything. And then when I would go during the middle of the night, and then I would just load my car so that I could stay in the house as long as possible. Because when I was attacked, all these people watched. Nobody did anything. Nobody helped. And I had post-traumatic stress, which I didn't realize at the time, but I became extremely agoraphobic. And OCD came with this too. I'm not sure why, but there's so much information coming in now, and I notice so much more that I'm always noticing what's been touched and what could possibly, have contaminated that. Like somebody's walking towards me and I see, the person rub their nose and then do something else, touch a doorknob, and then they walk up to me and want to shake their hand. And all I can think about is the germs that are there, and after I shake their hand, how I need to hand sanitize my hand. In fact, it was so bad, I was literally Lysoling my money and then putting it in the microwave for 30 seconds just to make sure I killed all the germs on the money. And what even made it worse is that it worked. I stopped getting sick. I've had three colds since this happened. And that reinforces
it. So it kind of reinforced it. Yeah.
So eventually, I went to a psychologist to help get better at it, to help control it.
But it took you about 10 years, didn't it?
Yes, to really get to the point of where I was in, back into life.
But at the same time, you're still seeing things with the grid. You're still seeing things pixelated. You're still experiencing the world in a profoundly different way.
Completely different.
And so why did it become important to express that to other people?
Well, I was one of those kids that all I did was goof off, party, chase girls, drink. And even, I shouldn't say kid, up even into adulthood, I was doing that. And I also said, math, this is stupid. After pre-algebra, I was like, you're not going to use this. This is ridiculous. I mean, I was one of those kids that really hated math. And suddenly I could see this underlying order to everything, and it was so beautiful. And I was finding that I was able to explain things like pi or relativity with drawings. And since all I had at the time was layman terms to explain it, I would draw it and then explain it in layman terms. And I was finding that everybody understood it. And for me, it was so beautiful. All I wanted to do was grab every single person that walked by and say, did you know this? Here, look at this. Did you know this? Because it was like the whole universe opened up. It's like having two different lives, where all I could do was talk about it, literally. It's like, but at the same time, I felt agoraphobic, wanting to be alone. But at the same time, I wanted to tell everybody, look how beautiful this is. You can learn it. You think you don't like math, but you're just not seeing it the right way.
You had a wonderful phrase. I think it was one of your math teachers when you went back to community college said, you don't have the vocabulary yet to talk about this. Have you learned that?
Yeah, I've gone back to school and I've taken, all the standard math classes through the calculus series and up into linear algebra, which is probably junior level. But it was amazing for me because the very first time I went to algebra, I didn't know that an equation was graphed. So they graphed this equation and I was like, wait a second. Do you mean all equations are talking about geometry? And my teacher was like, yes. Everything we're doing is discussing or describing the geometry of the universe. And I'm like, well, I'm just drawing it in its natural form, and you're doing equations, but we're talking about the same thing, just in two different languages. Only the language of geometry is the natural language of math, whereas equations we have made up to describe the geometry. But the equations are good because they can prove things. They're done in a way that you can prove it, whereas if I draw a picture of pi, it doesn't prove it. But after I went back to school, of course, then I learned how to write the equation to prove that what I drew really was pi.
We're talking about this sort of savant syndrome that came on as a result of this attack. You're also talking about synesthesia, too, and
right.
you became a synesthete, right? That was not something you were born with.
No.
And so what form of synesthesia do you have?
It's just this grid structure, seeing numbers as grid. Like, say the number four is just – well, it depends on how you do it, but four could be, you know, four grids in a row or four in a square. Like, for instance, if we had four as a square, so we have four squares, little squares, making a square that gives us a total of four squares, making one square. So that's the number four. And then four to the second power, four squared, is taking that four – and geometrically squaring it into 16. 4 cubed is taking that and three-dimensionally cubing it into 64. It's one and the same thing, or the third root of 64. If you take that cube of 64 and you take it apart into its root, becomes that four, those four cubes.
And that's how you see it.
That's how I see it, yeah.
So when if I say four to you,
right.
that's there.
That's it.
You know, I've known people who've had other kinds of synesthesia, the kinds where you attach colors to letters or numbers and will change depending on what letters and numbers are next to each other and that sort of thing. And I know there are synesthetes who can taste sound or hear tastes.
Yeah, they say that smells like blue and you're like, huh.
But that's not something that you
no.
– but it must have been amazing to finally talk to people who had a similar kind of thing, even if it wasn't exactly what you had.
Right.
It didn't maybe manifest in exactly the same way, but it was the same idea that these senses were all intermingling.
Yes. I was watching a show and I saw this guy named Daniel Tammet, and he memorized pi to like 22,500 decimals, and he was talking about the way his numbers looked to him. And I remember being so excited, realizing that, okay, this is something that is real. Because there was a lot of times, you know, in that 3 years where I was by myself where I was like, you know, when you see somebody that's really crazy and they don't know it, am I one of those people right now that I'm drawing all this stuff and saying, this is pi at this value, and I'm the only one that thinks it, you know, and I just don't know that I'm crazy? And so it was very nice to see that this was something that was real. And then, of course, going back to school to be able to prove that that was pi was just absolutely awesome. I recommend, you know, everybody, you know, go to school for sure. And at least see if you like it, you know, and try to learn pi and relativity this way if you can before you go to school.
And see what happens.
And see what happens, yeah. And if you like it, great.
Wisconsin also played a key part of your new life. And there was a gentleman in Fond du Lac, right?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Dr. Treffert. He was the real Rain Man, Kim Peek. He studied him and he also advised on the movie The Rain Man. And he's the leading savant expert. He diagnosed me. And I came to Fond du Lac and got to visit him there, and it was wonderful. He was very nice, showed me around. It helped introduce me to other people in the world that are studying savant syndrome also. And finally being able to be diagnosed, know what was going on, and start connecting to people and getting brain studies done to see what exactly had happened. Because there was, you know, negative things that came with it too. Like me holding up in my house, I had post-traumatic stress and OCD came with it. I get these uncontrolled muscle movements several hundred times a day. It kind of feels like my phone vibrating, and that happens all throughout my body. And I was worried, you know, that I had MS or ALS, and all those other things were ruled out. It turns out there's something called benign muscle fasciculations where it's just they don't know why, but your muscles just move by themselves, but it's not going to kill you.
It's not a disease per se.
But I was really worried that
sure.
I was. Yeah,
sure. Why wouldn't you be? Yeah. You know, it's something you'd never had before.
Right.
Do you ever fear that this you will disappear and you'll revert?
I've heard about a case where a lady had, I think she had dementia, and she was able to draw these amazing paintings, and then slowly as the dementia got worse, it did go away. And I used to worry about it a lot more. Now, it's been so long, I don't think it will, you know, but anything's possible, but I don't think it will. I certainly hope it doesn't, you know, and I certainly hope I don't ever revert back to the way I was, you know, even if like suddenly I couldn't see things like that. Hopefully the effects of everything that I've been through will keep my personality more like this, because I feel like I definitely have two different lives, and a large portion of my personality is different in many ways too. So it definitely feels like two lives, but I would not want it to go away, even with the bad that came with it. The good so overwhelms the bad that it's worth it.
Do you feel that you have the vocabulary now, or is there still more to learn? Oh,
there's a lot more. I mean, I have the vocabulary in a certain way, but every time I talk to these PhDs, they know so much more than I do in certain ways, and I just – like savant syndrome, some people who love the term is not nice. They would say idiot savant, you know, meaning that you're either normal or less than normal in most things, and you just excel at this one particular area. And so I definitely have a lot to learn about everything. And that's all I want to do is just learn. But I would be satisfied if I could just get the few things that I've drawn out into the curriculum to really help, you know, bring the level of our kids up a little higher, because that's one thing that our country needs to do is to help our kids with math, get them more interested in it, show them how it does apply. In fact, there's nothing that you can't use it for. So all of those people that say, oh, that's silly, you can't use that in real life, you do, and you use it all the time, and there's nothing that you can't apply it to. It's just learning how that you can apply it. The one problem is also is that when you go to taking traditional mathematics, you're pretty much learning rules until you get to calculus. And once you start going through calculus, it all starts to come together. And that's when it gets really powerful. But the problem is most of us don't make it to calculus.
Well, Jason Padgett, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Jason Padgett's memoir, co-written with Maureen Seberg, herself a synesthete, is called Struck by Genius: How a Brain Injury Made Me a Mathematical Marvel. He spoke with Bonnie North in May. Another break now, and then we'll speak with acclaimed novelist and Green Bay native Mona Simpson about her latest novel and thoughts of her hometown. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. When you're a kid, a lot of the world seems like a mystery in need of figuring out. And probably the most obvious example of that is figuring out your own parents. That's what Miles Adler Hart sets out to do from a pretty young age. He's the fictional hero of Green Bay native Mona Simpson's latest novel, Casebook. Miles goes so far as to employ investigative techniques to snoop on his mother as she and his father divorce, and she starts dating the mysterious Eli. Over the years the book covers, Miles not only learns about the inner workings of adulthood, he begins to understand more about himself. Mona Simpson, whose other books include the well-regarded Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road, was back in Wisconsin recently, and she stopped by our Studio B. Thanks so much for being here. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Do you think mother-son relationships are explored enough in literature?
That's a good question. I suppose I can think of some if I really put my mind to it. It's funny. It's something I haven't actually thought about. I'm thinking – when you first say that, I'm thinking of this great scene, I guess, in War and Peace where the mother of the hero is quite desperate to get the money for his education. I think she's a poor widow, and she goes to ask her wealthy friend to borrow money for his education. And that's one. Of course, that's a grown son and
sure.
A grown mother. But I guess you're probably asking that since I've written a book about a mother and a son.
Well, yeah, exactly. And as I thought about many of the books that I've read, certainly in recent years, there's a lot of mother-daughter relationships that are portrayed. But it's rare to consider how a mother and son affect each other.
I think that's true. Now that I think of it, I hadn't actually thought of that before. But I think it's interesting to write about kind of the way we live now with the family. So in this case, it's a divorced mom and a son who has little sisters. So he's sort of the man of the family, which I think is a kind of a new iteration a little bit and has its own complexity.
Well, and you say it's the something to the way we live now, and I got to thinking this is set in Southern California, and I wonder if there's something – you know, you grew up in Wisconsin, but you now live in California. It's hard for me to imagine this book being set in Wisconsin. Is this a California novel?
I don't think so. I think this book could be set in Wisconsin. I mean, the sort of central themes of sort of spying on one's parents and wanting to protect one's parent and not being able to, especially in the case of divorce, that happens here too.
Well, certainly, yeah. And maybe it's just there's certain specifics to the setting that feel
right.
Very California.
Yes,
certainly they feel foreign to Wisconsin.
Yes, it's definitely set in L.A.
The issue that comes up repeatedly in conversations between Miles, who's your protagonist, and his best friend Hector, who's kind of a secondary protagonist, if you will, is this idea of whether they are happier with their parents apart. And that's a question that I remember asking myself a lot when my parents divorced. Is that a question you've turned over in your head a good deal?
You know, it's funny. It's a funny thing about writing books, but you find yourself learning – I wouldn't have actually said that if you'd asked me that 5 years ago before I wrote this book. And yet I grew up with divorced parents and I probably did have it exactly that thought. Although in my case, I don't really remember my parents together. They divorced when I was quite young. But I think it is a sort of question. And I think it's also, in a funny way, I think it's a typical question of divorced children, because one of the things about divorce, if you're the child, is how little power you have in it. And it's a way of trying to think whether or not you would rather they'd be back together or not is a way of almost assuming that you do have some control in a situation where really you don't.
Well, and it strikes me that Miles, who's kind of – he's narrating this in retrospect, but he's really growing up as the novel progresses.
Right.
And he seems like he's kind of coming to terms with understanding his own power.
Right. And how much of it he has and how much of it he doesn't have.
There's a lot made of the phenomenon of the unreliable narrator in fiction. But I was thinking about Miles as the narrator, and I wonder if he could be anything but unreliable in a way, because he's sort of in this position where he doesn't have a lot of power and he only has access to a certain part of really what's his own story.
Right. I think that's certainly true, although he's trying to be reliable, which makes a difference. you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it strikes me one of the real – what you've really managed to pull off in this book is that as he gets older, he gets somewhat more reliable.
Yeah.
As though his memory, you know, it's not that it failed him, but he only understood a certain number of things
right.
when he was 9 or 10.
Right. And at moments, I think the reader even understands a little bit more than he does.
How challenging was it for you to channel a teenage boy, a growing teenage boy, as a narrator?
Well, it felt kind of natural to me, perhaps because I've lived with one for a while. I'm not sure he thought that it was also so pitch perfect. So I had some of my male students read it to sort of get an external vantage. I think it was – I like channeling – people, for whatever reason, who have some kind of interesting new take on vernacular English. But also for me, for this story, I don't know quite else how I didn't – it didn't really start moving until I had that vantage.
Well, and so did the story start with Miles for you?
Well, I wanted to tell a love story and it's embedded in this story. And I sort of started noodling around with it, but it didn't really start moving and come to life until I hit on Miles's investigation of it.
And it's interesting because, well, I should just ask you, you think of it as a love story. Do you also think of it as a mystery or
I
is
do.
It,
I think of it as sort of both. I mean, a mystery in the sense of, you know, there's no great crime. Some people would say there's a crime, but there's not a prosecutable crime in it. So it's a mystery story applied to the emotional and moral dimensions rather than the criminal.
a mystery in so much as people figuring out the world around them is, right. is kind of a continual mystery. I mean, I think about your adults who are certainly the Mims is a mathematician, and this speaks to mystery in itself as well.
Yeah.
Was there a central question that you wanted to address as Miles came to you?
I wanted to kind of talk about romantic love and whether it was, I guess you could say, a good idea. And I wanted these kids to be sort of pondering that as they grow up and trying to figure out whether that should have a place in their life or whether there are other more reliable, more accountable kinds of affection that ought to take priority.
I wonder if there's something more organic about kids asking these questions than adults who have already perhaps have their formed opinions about, you know, whether romantic love is worth it or not.
Right. I think there is something to that. And also Miles has a natural sort of suspicion, and he and his friend are very suspicious. And yet they're quite innocent really in terms of their own feelings. Like, and when something goes wrong, he doesn't have the sort of collection of received assumptions or received ideas of people get over things and, you know, no one dies of love. No, he doesn't have any of those ideas. So he's ready to scream. He's got a kind of raw pain and he'll feel it.
And it's interesting because we think today of teenagers as being a really kind of sexualized bunch. But
not these two.
Yeah, they are both sort of intrigued and also repelled by the idea of sex.
They are. And they're also kind of, I guess you could call them nerds. They're kind of on the outskirts of the mainstream social life of their school. They're not completely out of it, but they're definitely not really mingling in it so much. They occasionally try to, and at moments they get a little close, but they're still in that phase where the most important person really in each other's life is each other. And it's interesting for Miles because he is attracted to girls, and there's one girl in particular he has romantic feelings about, but he realizes that she's not nearly as important to him really as Hector, who he essentially collaborates with about everything, all his major projects in life.
And he and Hector are both from homes where the parents have split up, and it strikes me that neither of them has a particularly good model to work from. Miles's mom is in this furtive relationship with Eli, who, you know, as things play out, is a little mysterious, exactly. And it's certainly not something that he would base a romantic relationship on in watching his mom and Eli, or even thinking
and
back
his
on
dad,
his mom and dad.
His dad is getting letters under the door from who knows who. although Hector's parents do begin to find other people.
What should we make of the fact that Miles doesn't call his mom. He refers to her as the Mims, and he refers to his sisters as the Boops.
He's just got a – he feels he has sort of a little bit of a take on family life. I think he's not quite to the point of calling his mother by her name, but he doesn't want to call her mom. He feels too grown up for that.
Let me ask you just a little bit about craft. When you conceived of Miles, did you already in your head know where he was and where he was going?
I didn't exactly know where he was at the end. I knew the age he was, and I knew some of the experiences he'd had. The whole business with college and all and what happens with that, I kind of figured that out as I went along.
And you didn't need to have that planned out before you started?
Well, the way I usually do it is I write a draft and then I revise it many, many, many times. So in a way, that's a kind of – some people outline, some people write a draft. It almost serves the same purpose.
The draft is the outline in this case.
Or I tinker with it there. From there, I make the changes.
I'm curious to have you think back on your time in Green Bay because you are back in Wisconsin, and – as a writer who deals a lot in setting, I'm curious how you see Wisconsin and your trips. I don't know whether you think of it as home still versus the Green Bay you knew.
You know, I kind of do and I don't. And it's interesting. I was just home in Green Bay mainly to see family and to see two people. One is my mom's very close friend who's 83, and one is a woman who's 95. But actually, I came back to Wisconsin, oh gosh, a little more than a year ago, last spring, for a family funeral. And when I was there, it did strike me that I wanted to write more about Green Bay, that I'd written about it a little bit in Anywhere But Here, but I'd written about sort of the Wisconsin, just the limited part of Green Bay that I knew. And it's such an interesting city. I mean, there's so much going on with the between the paper mills and the packing factories and the meat packing factories and the canning factories and the populations who are there to work in them. And yet it's so interesting. I went to a benefit last night at Heritage Hill, which is a sort of beautiful – it's sort of the Green Bay Historical Society. And it's a beautiful place on a hill. But it's less than a mile away from what used to be called, when I was growing up there, the reformatory, and which is now the Wisconsin Correctional Facility. It's a maximum security prison with, you know, armed
– guard towers.
Yeah, guard towers with armed sentinels, you know, and all the corners and even maybe even more than just the corners. It's an interesting town that way. And also there's St. Norbert's College, which is a sort of bucolic Catholic college. And right up butting it is a huge sort of 18th century brick paper mill spewing, you know, smoke into the air over the river. It's a fascinating place.
Does Green Bay feel smaller to you than it did when you were growing
up?
No,
it now seems bigger. It has grown quite a bit, actually. It's really incredible. I mean, Alice Munro in some of her work writes about how the country was sort of opened in the early 19th century, the late 1880s. But it's fascinating to see just since I left, I probably left in 1970, the fields and the farmland that's just been developed and how the stages and it's still going on. I mean, you see new houses with huge piles of excavated dirt.
It's interesting to think of it as larger than when you were growing up there. I mean, I think myself of I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm, Green Bay's pretty small for you then.
Green Bay is very small. But
it's a city. It's not – it doesn't feel like a small town. It definitely feels like a city.
Right. It has very much a – I mean, we think of Milwaukee in ways that sometimes it's almost like a miniature Chicago.
Right,
and I wonder
right.
if Green Bay is in a way a miniature Milwaukee.
It's interesting. I think it is a little bit.
But it was definitely a different place.
Definitely a different place.
And that to me, as I make this comparison, Washington and Baltimore in the 70s and 80s, if you drove to Baltimore, it was like going someplace else.
Whereas now it doesn't feel like that. That's really true, isn't it?
So the world is getting larger and getting smaller
and more
at the
connected.
Same time.
Yeah.
You say you do and you don't think of it as home. Does California feel like home?
It does a little bit, but Green Bay does too. I mean, no one could. Certainly I couldn't, but I think almost no one could fully understand California, you know, Southern California. There's so many factors in its history. It's so big. It's got so many huge issues of water and power and all that, language and immigration. I don't yet, but I feel like I maybe could understand Green Bay. You know, I have a lot of intuitions about the place, so it's a matter of learning what's happened since I left. It has a kind of magic for me.
Well, and do you go back to a place like Green Bay as a writer or – I mean,
As a person. I was thinking that both, certainly both. I think first as a person, but second, you do feel little tingles that seem like, oh, there could be a story here.
And I wonder if you can start connecting the dots of things that you remember and things start to make sense.
Yeah, and just the way people talk and the way people tell a story, there's a lot of sort of deep familiarity. But then there's a lot that's new too, so that's exciting.
Well, we will anxiously await what emerges from that.
Thank you.
Mona Simpson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Green Bay native Mona Simpson is the author of such well-known books as Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road. Her latest novel is Casebook, which came out in April. She stopped by the Lake Effect studio on a recent trip back to Wisconsin to visit family and friends. One last break, and then we'll catch up with the top kora player in the Milwaukee area, some West African music from Yaya Kambai, when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. We first met musician and Senegal native Yahya Kambaye on this show about a year and a half ago. He plays the kora, an instrument featuring 22 strings and a large gourd for a body. Kambaye and guitarist Carl Nichols will play a Milwaukee area concert later this summer, and we invited them back into the studio for a few more songs this year, one of which we're hearing now. Yahya Kambaye on the 22-string kora and Carl Nichols on guitar in Lake Effect's performance studio. We'll hear the other songs they played later in the summer. Tomorrow on the show, though, music of a much different brassy sort and really a preview of this weekend's AVP Milwaukee Open Pro Beach Volleyball Tournament. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's so great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening. Coming your way at noon, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. Right now, though, it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.